on this episode of The Kinked Wire.
I wanted to practice clinically oriented IR. So I sort of thought, hey, you know what? If I go to a group and say, we should practice IR, my group is going to say, yes, you should go for it. And as many people know, that's not the way the world works.
Welcome to The Kinked Wire, the Interventional Radiology podcast from SIR's IR Quarterly magazine. You can learn more at our website, sirweb.org/kinkedwire. And this episode is brought to you by BD. Learn more at bardpb.com. In this episode, Kinked Wire host Warren Krakoff speaks with interventional radiologist Raj Pine about the development of IR services in his Rochester, New York practice, leadership roles he's held for the Society of Interventional Radiology, and advice he gives today's IR residents.
Hey, Raj, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I don't know if you remember, actually, there's no reason why you would, but I actually grew up in Rochester, New York. So don't hold that against me, but how are things going with COVID up there?
Good. I think I'm fortunate that, you know, we're definitely getting better here. It was scary for a while, nothing like New York City and all the IR docs I know there, but I feel like I should maybe be asking you the same question in Florida.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, it's pretty bad down here right now.
I know. I feel so bad for everywhere it's spreading out. In Rochester, I think we're very lucky. I think the patients, the people, genuinely they care about each other and for the most part follow the rules. People are wearing masks. So overall, I mean, patient-wise, we're doing pretty good. We had a, you know, at a certain point in April and May, we had a pretty high prevalence. A lot of our ICUs were filled. As an IR group, I think I've talked to some other IRs. They did the same thing where we actually split into two different groups, two of our attendings, two of our senior residents, each of our PAs split into a group, and we actually covered a week at a time to try to separate us and quarantine from each other in case somebody got it. But luckily, none of us got it. I think we're very lucky for that. Overall, I think we were probably busier than normal. I feel like we took on a lot of the surgical procedures that weren't happening that needed anesthesia, like G-tubes and ports and some of the cholecystectomies that a lot of times they were, you know, being sort of pushed off that we otherwise would sort of split with other groups. We started taking them all on. Our calls were more. We had a week where I remember every single night during that week we got called in for something big and we kept on going.
Wow.
So, you know, for me, I think the toughest part was, you know, we had a COVID patient, you know, wearing those face shields and the N95. I mean, it's really uncomfortable. It's hard to communicate with your techs and nurses. We're always worried about, you know, the shortages and things like that. But
yeah.
If I had to pick out one thing, I think what I was worried about most is, you know, we have a private vein practice. And obviously, outpatient an office is very challenging when COVID shuts you down. My biggest stress at that time also was all the employees I have, you know, surviving with that revenue, how we're going to deal with that. That was one of the biggest stressors after the medical issue was really taking care of our employees at our private office.
How is that turning out?
I suspect a lot of people will relate to this, but I think it's just continuing to reinvent yourself. You know, we got a small loan from the government, which was very helpful. But, you know, as being a doc in a private office, you consider yourself almost like a business owner, and you're very responsible for your employees and, you know, their families and their livelihood. So we've changed everything. We went down a lot to having one patient every hour, separate entrance and exit, you know, all these things. And, you know, a lot of the times they won't give the PPE to small offices because they're saving everything for the bigger hospitals and COVID patients. So
right.
The whole thing has been challenging. We keep on reinventing ourselves. But I think over time now, we're actually starting to pick up again. I'll tell you that starting after COVID, we stopped, I think, March 15th, and we opened up June 1st. And it's almost been like starting the practice over from new because a lot of our patients are stopped. A lot of patients were scared to come in. It's almost like we started a new practice. So it's been really frustrating and hard, but it really puts things in perspective.
You know, it strikes me. I remember talking to you, you know, offline a few years ago as you were building things. You know, you seem to me anyway, like you always had a vision and a plan for how things were going to work in terms of your outpatient practice and so on. Is that the case? I mean, did you have ideas, you know, sort of going into the practice that you ended up at there in Rochester about how you wanted to build things and what you wanted to do?
Yes and no. I think coming out of fellowship, I was so naive as to what the world was like. So I think I knew that one, academic versus private practice, I didn't know the difference between the two. I didn't know there was anything besides those two, I guess, a better way to say it. So I knew that I wanted sort of a mix of both, but I didn't know how that was going to work. So I wanted to practice clinically oriented IR. I did not realize how hard that would be if we were not in academics. So I sort of thought, hey, you know what? If I go to a group and say, we should practice clinically oriented IR, my group is going to say, yes, you should go for it. And as many people know, that's not the way the world works.
Right.
Again, with the way the vein practice works, I became very passionate. I did a 2-week elective in fellowship about outpatient vein work, and I really liked it. So I really thought I wanted to open up a separate private bane practice, which also was a work in itself. And the last thing, I really thought I wanted to do some teaching, which is ironic to go into private practice to think that I wanted to start a residency. But part of the work I did was to try to open up and start an IR residency, which is challenging because it was in a place that didn't have an IR fellowship. So that was a labor of love, to say the least.
I was going to say, when you look back now at many of the incredible things you've accomplished, you know, many big academic centers can't necessarily claim to have accomplished all of those things. So you should be proud of what you've done. Did you have to work with your diagnostic radiology colleagues a bit to sort of get things rolling the way you wanted to?
The clinical practice, most of my radiology partner, my DR partners are extremely supportive of things, and some of them aren't. So clinically oriented practice, it sort of flies in the face of what a lot of times we're trying to achieve in terms of efficiency, RVUs, work RVUs, and professional RVUs, you know, really streamlining the practice. You know, if you're talking about in the DR world, you're trying to get your list as small as you can, get your outpatient, high revenue imaging, you know, as increased as you can, and deal with the hospitals the best way you can. You know, what really flies in the face of that is saying that I want to take the IR procedures and start doing clinic and a consult service and admitting patients and really dealing with a lot of the stuff that takes a lot of manpower that doesn't generate great RVUs. And I think that was challenging, but for the most part, the hospital is sort of supporting it. And for the most part, my partners did support it. In terms of the vein in practice, my IR partners definitely bought in and they wanted to do it. And a lot of the DR partners did, and they were actually really supportive. But, you know, again, a lot of that's going to be, can you show a pro forma or a business model showing that it can be successful? And then the question is, can you actually implement that? And then the final thing, I guess, would be the residency. That was a lot of work. They were actually supportive. So at the end of the day, now we have a fully functioning IR residency, which is, again, a labor of love. It's a lot of work, but if it's something you're passionate about, the years that go into it, it makes sense at the end of the day. And now we're a much better service, I think, for it.
I think for a lot of folks probably listening to this, maybe who are a little bit on the earlier part of their career arc, I think this is probably pretty inspiring for them because, you know, many people may have those visions and you know, they may be IR residents themselves and say, hey, look, how do I do this? What do you say to those people? What kinds of advice would you give them?
I would say you really have to decide, you know, first, if you want to join a pre-existing successful practice, or if you want to build it. And that's a question that I suspect a lot of people may not want to do because, you know, there's a lot of inherent risk in building a practice and taking the time and the effort and the energy to do that. And at the end of it, you still might not have what you want, which is why I think a lot of people look for a proven product. That being said, I think when I joined, to have a practice that my partners were saying, you know, let's mold this together, let's build this together, let's create something special, I actually wanted that. I actually savored that and really looked forward to doing that, even though I know it was very time consuming and a lot of effort. And there was a lot of losses along the way. So, you know, well, number one, I think there's no easy solution. It takes time would be my advice. Number two, I think the key question, you know, when you want something, you have to say, how am I going to show the value for what I want? Nobody will just sort of trust you and say, hey, you know, Raja, that's a great idea, so let's do it, even though I think I might be a net loser in clinically or safety or financially. So I think you have to ask yourself a question. A lot of times you have to write this down. This is what I always tell people. So I would say probably identify who are the stakeholders. If you're like me in a diagnostic IR mixed group, do you have to show the value, whatever value it is, to the DR partners? Do you have to show it to your radiology admin or your practice manager? You know, Warren, in your case, I mean, would it be a national company or an entity, or, you know, would it be a separate hospital or another, your IR partners? Do you have to get buy-in from nurses and techs? We just took over a new hospital where the culture is very different. You know, for something, you have to get buy-in from your nurses and techs, the PAs and the NPs. And I think one of the hardest things is maybe that your own IR partners might not want something. So you really have to figure out who the stakeholders are for what your idea or what you're suggesting or what your vision is. And then you have to sort of figure out what is the value. You have to really define that. A better way to say it is, I have a vision that maybe a lot of people just really don't see what I'm saying. So you have to really define it and really put it out there definitively. And for a lot of people, talking probably to the hospital admin or your practice manager is probably financial. You know, realistically, you have to say, you know, what is the dollars in and out? What are the business performance? And if you don't know what that means, or if you don't know what a profit and loss statement is, you should probably get used to that before you talk to some of these people. You have to extrapolate the language, you know, look 5 years in the future and say, how is this project going to potentially, you know, make us money, or at the very least be a zero-sum game and not lose money? The other thing you might have to ask is, clinically, is it better for patients? Is it, you know, going to improve something? This is the age-old question I know for most IRs is, you open up an IR clinic and you want to see patients as an outpatient clinic. Does that bring value? I mean, is that better for the patients, or is it better when you go somewhere and they will just sort of come in and be on your table and a procedure is done because it's out of the doctor? So for many people who have done clinical IR, it's incredibly important to see that patient. But a lot of people don't share your vision, so you have to explain why clinically it's better. For a lot of people in the hospital also, it might be safety, right? As many people know, and I'm sure you probably know, as soon as you say there's something that's a patient safety issue or a satisfaction issue on, you know, one of the press gaining scores, that might be something that really triggers people to say, you know what, let's change something. So I think you really have to define what that value is, and it might be different for different people. It might be multiple. And then finally, when you're asking what you have to achieve, you have to make that blueprint. You know, why it makes sense to your patients. You know, what are the outcomes that might change? Simultaneously, what is going to make people money or not lose them money? And then finally, if you actually get approval for it, everybody else buys in, you have to be passionate enough to actually spend the time, your money. And to be honest with you, when I did clinic in the beginning, a lot of times I would come into my vacation weeks and see patients in the clinic. You have to be able to really dedicate your time and be passionate about that. I think over time, you get the small wins, you get those little goals, and they come and go. And you might not see them as really victories, but over time, you see the needle start pushing forward. And overall, you know, there's this wave of inertia that will finally shift, and the paradigm will move forward.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's spot on. And, you know, I mean, I think really sort of defining who each of the stakeholders is and what he or she wants and showing how you can provide that or at least not make things worse. You know,
it sounds very easy after the fact that I'm saying this. I just want to say, believe me, there were so many losses in that. There were so many times that I said something or I presented something and people said, I don't know what you're talking about. This doesn't make sense. This is literally going to cost us thousands of dollars. I wanted to get a room. You know, people say that's millions of dollars. I remember the first time I saw a profit and loss statement in my vein practice. I did not know what that meant. You know, you have to learn these things. Yeah. You know, a lot of it's also getting over and getting used to losing and not having your voice heard and taking a lot of losses and saying, you know what, I'm going to persevere and keep on going with that.
You know, clearly you learn those lessons well and hope that a lot of our colleagues learn from what you're talking about. I mean, and it occurs to me too that, you know, being the member services division counselor now, you know, that may be a way where you can pivot a little bit into providing some of that. I mean, you've had other roles in SIR, but how does doing what you're doing right now compare to what you've done in the past for SIR?
Sort of thinking about how I got involved and where I am now. You know, IRQ is a magazine that, and I know you were editor of that, and now I'm editor of that, and used to read IRQ. I loved reading it. I thought it was fascinating because as much as I like JBR, I used to like to read opinion pieces too. I thought it was really fascinating about how people viewed IR and viewed the practice and all these little things, all these nuances, and I thought it was really great. You know, sometimes it's as easy as that. That was me one day saying, you know, maybe I should just really sort of get involved. And SIR, to be honest with you, I always thought it was very challenging as a private practice to get involved. I really always wanted to speak or help out or do whatever I could, but I thought you couldn't get involved in committees or speak if there wasn't sort of somebody, a mentor or somebody else sort of bringing you in from academics. There was no RFS, which is the resident fellow section. And what I really think sort of helped was that I was part of the inaugural early career section or ECS. If I wasn't available, I was there and when people started suggesting it and I applied for that. I got to help with that, even though I was a little bit farther out. I was about 5 or 6 years out at the time. So I just wanted to get involved in some way. And that, I think, really sort of got it going for me. I don't think I've ever told any of this, but at that time, I was so wanting to get involved that I know they had an open application for the SIR conference. I didn't have experience in anything, and I just brashly applied to be the annual conference chair because I thought I wanted to get private practice people involved. But it was more of a statement for me to say, I really want to make sure that there's a voice heard. And to be honest with you, most of the people are in private practice in some form or another, which just means non-academics. 70-80% of the people we're thinking are in private practice. So I really wanted to give them a voice. And then I think the key thing that really helped me was Tori Andrews. I think when he called me, one of the SIRs, and said, hey, they're starting a private practice task force, but, you know, I don't know if you want to be on that. And that really sort of helped open some doors. And once you get doors open, I think, you know, in most things, if a door opens and people see you worked hard, they want to get you involved. So I think that's how it started. And then I became a private practice counselor. And then, you know, from there, I'm just trying to help whatever I can. And, you know, for the most part, it hasn't really changed anything of what I do at my work. But it's just, I think it gives me a little more voice to help people, not just in the private practice, but, you know, in different areas. And it's always good to have somebody who's in private practice or in a DR joint group or somebody who's similar to you in some way, where there's maybe diversity. If you see somebody your same race or religion or gender or, you know, anything like that, to see somebody in that position, I think it's very empowering. And that's why it's been very nice for me that, you know, when I have some junior or early career private practice or somebody reach out, even residents reach out, I'm more than happy and really humbled to talk to them because it was literally me a couple years ago.
I'm really struck as we're talking about all this. You've really become, you know, I don't know, a mover and shaker and, you know, in IR. And, you know, I think about your IR residents, and I'm sure they're learning a lot of technique and so on and so forth. But I can't help but think that the amount that they're learning from you, you know, that has nothing to do with actually, you know, where to put the wire is just amazing. And I'm sure that word will start to get out, and that will be among the best IR residencies that you could get, because there's just so much extra information that you've got to give to these young trainees. And, you know, I'm glad that things are starting to come full circle for you. As we begin to sort of finish up here, we always ask our guests a question. You know, sometimes it's a little bit challenging, but we want to put you on the spot a little bit here and say, if you had the power to change one thing in healthcare, what would it be?
Wow, that's one thing in healthcare. I think maybe insurance is probably the thing that really bothers me the most. I think I would change the fact that insurance companies have so much undue influence in healthcare. I think one of the things that probably gets me the most is recently I've had a pelvic congestion that was denied, and I had a Y90 that was denied. The Y90 was denied for what reason, we don't know. We
really
worked jointly with our radiation oncologist. The guy's already treated years ago, and our radiation oncologist said, oh, you know, I'll submit this. You're off next week, so I'll submit it. He submitted it and got completely denied. He appealed it, got denied again. He said, I don't know what to do. We were going to, you know, change and do something else. And then, of course, I went and I asked without even doing anything. And they said yes. So I knew that it was literally either wording or just something silly. And that's the difference in this guy's management of care. And it might be a computer checklist or a text checker or, you know, maybe, you know, somebody on the other end who's not clinical at all, who would approve or deny that. And then just yesterday, I got denied a treatment for pelvic congestion. I do a lot of pelvic congestion for my patients. I have a woman who is in just debilitating pain, and she desperately wants to. She's come from very far away. We got, you know, everything set to go. She's ready to do this. An insurance company denied it. And her insurance person said, you know what? They actually aren't denying it. She said, I think they're doing that, so you can't appeal it. She said, if they don't officially deny it, you can't officially appeal it or get an external appeal. I said, that is incredibly tricky and taking the bureaucracy to another level. But I would say to people, if you're going to be a good IR or any clinician, part of your game now is going to be fighting the insurance battle. And I think that's very, very sad. So I don't know what the answer would be, but maybe having a peer-to-peer with another IR or somebody in a similar situation who would actually understand and really sort of, you know, get to the bottom of whether somebody needs it or not. And maybe getting, you know, people who may be overdoing procedures that they don't need to, fine, maybe singling those people out. But, you know, I really have a problem with the denials for denial's sake or for petty reasons.
I think you would have thousands of people agreeing with you on that.
I'm sure that people are not out of their heads.
Hey, listen, Raj, thanks so much. It's been great catching up here a little bit and chatting. I wish you all the best. Please continue to stay healthy and good luck to you.
I just want to give a shout out to you guys. This is a great podcast. Love listening to it. It's been an honor to be on it. Thank you.
That was Dr. Raj Pine talking about the leadership roles he's played within his practice and within SIR. We thank Dr. Pine for his time, BD for supporting this episode, and you for listening to the Kinked Wire. Our host is Dr. Warren Krakoff. Our editor is Dr. Jamin Shaw. Our production manager is Dr. Jason Fisher. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have any thoughts or ideas for us, drop us a line at irq@sirweb.org.